once again to another edition of what I call American Exposé. This is Chris Kerner. It's the 4th of August, 2005. This is the beginning of a marathon broadcast. The beginning of a marathon broadcast, as it appears I'll be doing John Stadmiller's show today as well. 4 hours. Yesterday we had Jeff in New Mexico calling about stating the good points of the Communist Party USA on the website, AmericanExpose.com, more than likely is where he saw it. And I wanted to reference to him, and certainly that the Communist Party USA, when you go to that website, it sounds just like you and me. It really does, and I've been saying this all along. This is part of the lure to get you in, but once you understand what it's all about, then and you can see the experience of other countries and how people are trying to escape other countries to get to freedom in this country, supposedly. And this is the last outpost for freedom, as it's being eroded, slowly but surely, by the Hegelian dialectic. So once again, I wanted to refer to Jeff in New Mexico about that Title 50, Chapter 23, Subchapter Roman Numeral 4, and I think Darren fixed it, or Dennis, and it's up again, and right next to the Communist Party USA on the left, U.S. Congress finds and declares the Communist Party of the United States, although purportedly a political party, is in fact an instrumentality of a conspiracy to overthrow the government of the United States. It's in the U.S. Code, listeners. And this is what I referenced to Jeff in New Mexico. This is not me. This is our government making these statements printed in the U.S. Code. And so it's in there. I just read the first sentence of a very large paragraph, and this is what we go by, listeners. We're going to have, hopefully, we do have Hansa with us. We're going to have, hopefully, Joseph D. Douglas, the author of Red Cocaine, The Drugging of America. Apparently, he might have forgotten, or he might have been sidetracked, but we hastily set up an engagement with him last night, and hopefully he'll be with us today. Otherwise, we move on with Hansa. Red Cocaine, The Drugging of America by Joseph D. Douglas, Jr. They talk about, for 20 years, the drug problem has been blamed on unprincipled traffickers whose only motivation is greed, and on users who provide the vast profits to a criminal cartel. No consideration has been given to another possibility, that the epidemic of illegal drugs is also the result of political warfare orchestrated by various communist powers against the West in general, and the United States in particular. This book, Red Cocaine, presents an abundance of evidence tying communist China, the Soviet Union, and other surrogates into international narcotics trafficking. This myth-shattering book, or work, includes testimony from high-level defectors, including one who received his orders direct from the Soviet Defense Council, confirming that the communists established drug trafficking networks to create income for themselves and to sow the seeds of self-destruction among their opponents. And there's more to this, but hopefully we'll get Joseph Douglas on, if not today, in the very, very near future. But we're going to keep trying that phone number to get him on. And we'll be back with Hansa Molina. You all know Hansa Molina, so your controversial calls that you made towards the end of the broadcast, let's start out with them today. Because we need to get to the bottom of all this. We're all trying to work together to restore a constitutional republic and state sovereignty. We'll be back to return with the broadcast. Stay with us. Broadcast called American Exposé. I'm Chris Gerner. We continue. Red Cocaine also confirms the unpleasant reality that U.S. officials have bent over backwards to avoid recognizing any such involvement by the communists. As this book documents, evidence of communist involvement in drug trafficking has been manipulated, deliberately suppressed, or simply ignored. While it is true that the United States has been waging a war on drugs for several years, and this book was written in 1990, listeners, the battle plans, such as they are, do not recognize the nature of the enemy or enemy's strategy. U.S. anti-narcotics strategy rests on three pillars: law enforcement, interdiction, and diplomacy. As Red Cocaine reveals, none of these is capable of combating the political warfare that is taking place. The war on drugs is doomed to be an expensive but futile failure unless the vital truths documented here are heeded in time. And this is our point, listeners. Hansa, welcome to the broadcast.
To be here.
Thank you, Hansa. And Dr. Douglas, welcome to the broadcast, sir.
It's my pleasure, Chris, to be with you.
Well, thank you very much. Hansa has been a guest on my broadcast for quite a few times, and we've done some shows. And listeners, we'll take your calls in the second hour. Let's just do this and be together, the three of us here, because Hansa has quoted from your book quite often, and I have your book as well. So, Hansa, say hello to Dr. Douglas.
Oh, Dr. Douglas, glad to talk to you finally.
Hi, Hansa. It's been a long time, hasn't it?
Yeah, I'm glad you... you sent me that videotape. I've been trying to spread it around, and it's going quite well. So.
Well, wonderful. Glad to hear that.
Yeah, that was a great presentation. I was going to ask you a couple questions. I did some research here, and
I tell you what, Hansa, hold on to your thoughts. Let's let the listeners hear a little bit of background of Dr. Douglas so they know who Dr. Douglas is. Do you mind, sir, that you sort of give a little background of your experience?
Oh, boy. I'd be glad to. My education is really in engineering, and I spent about 10 years at Cornell, and then ended up getting into defense studies for another 20 years, dealing with all sorts of areas, but ending up very much focused on the threat and doing considerable analysis using original source material based on the Soviet threat. I focused on original source material, which I mean is basically material from the Soviet Union, because at one time I started looking at the things that were coming out of our intelligence agency and comparing those with some actual Soviet materials, and I saw a great discrepancy between the two. It seemed that the U.S. Intelligence tended to be directed to support internal institutional positions and to support policy interests, but not to reveal the nature of the threat. So I focused almost my entire career not on worrying about what the intelligence community said, but looking at what the actual raw intelligence data was on the Soviet Union. And this was particularly a time when my background before that time was very useful, because I had a great deal of expertise in areas, sensitive areas of nuclear warfare and chemical and biological weapons that have become so important recently, and also command and control. So I knew the risks, the hazards, and strategies and background of the nuclear weapons area very, very well before I began reading the Soviet material. And what struck me about the Soviet material, this is basically original general staff writings that were some of which were very highly classified, but not used within the United States that well. And then later, a number of the highest-ranking defectors that have ever come to the United States, from whom I really learned how the system works from the inside. The materials from the Soviet Union were very interesting because they fit hand in glove with some of the most sophisticated analyses of what nuclear war would be like and what the implications were in terms of if one was going to be planning to fight a war. And, of course, the United States in the 60s departed from that type of thinking and said, well, all we want to do is deter a war because we cannot fight a war. And that's where they broke really with the Soviet Union, because the Soviet Union continued with what the United States had been in the early 50s, namely to prepare a war, recognizing that they believed that if you were prepared, you stood a chance of fighting and winning a nuclear war, particularly if your opponent did not prepare for war. And of course, another very important aspect of the Soviet strategy was a tremendous emphasis on deception. A deception in a way that the United States, particularly within the intelligence services, has never recognized. And a major portion of this deception was to get the enemy, that's us, to believe you couldn't fight a nuclear war, and hence all we should worry about is trying to deter a war, which is precisely what we did. It's very interesting the way in which the thinking and the strategies tended to differ almost by 180 degrees, and always to the Soviets' advantage should anything serious break out. Where things really changed in my career was after having a tremendous background in internal Soviet documentation, by a variety of very strange and unusual circumstances, I found myself working with a group of high-level defectors, most of whom I had identified by myself so that it kept them clear from the intelligence people. And one in particular was the highest-ranking defector ever to come to the United States. He came from Czechoslovakia. He was actually a member of the decision-making hierarchy. He was in on nearly all of the key decisions involving national security, intelligence operations, defense, military, foreign policy, and such, because he ran what was known as the Secretariat of the Defense Council. And the Defense Council, as it turns out, which the United States didn't even know existed when he defected, is higher than the Politburo. It is the decision-making body when it comes to questions of defense, national security, intelligence, and really the economy and foreign policy as well. I developed quite a good relationship with this gentleman, who really left because he was about to be arrested for trying to warn the Czech leadership that the Soviets were going to invade, which they did then in August, and how to make that invasion not necessary and block it, really, by doing the right things, which the Soviets didn't like, so they were about to arrest him and threw him in jail, at which point he was alerted to that fact and by friends within the inside, and then he proceeded to a very harrowing escape to get out of Czechoslovakia and defect to the United States. We spent a lot of time talking. He was a fascinating individual because not only was he right on the inside, but he had a tremendous knowledge and memory. It's very interesting, Chris. You know, I would later on, 15 years later or so, I would talk about a subject with him, and I would wonder, well, I wonder what we said the last time we talked about this. And I'd go back and pull out my notes from about 12 or 15 years earlier and found out that my notes regarding the conversations were almost identical in both cases. He had such a good memory, and he always had a policy that he adopted, which was never to talk about something you don't know something about. And when you do talk about something, to always be very factual and extremely correct about what you say. In other words, don't shade the truth. And don't play games with the truth, which saved him on many occasions. And it was particularly interesting also in retrospect was the number of times the people in the U.S. intelligence community, the few times they talked to him, tried to get him to change his story so it would reflect the institutional positions and not reality. But he would never do that. So I became very good friends with him. And as time went on, I started doing some work on my own. And one of these led me into looking at the narcotics problem, which is, of course, the whole story behind red cocaine. But that's sort of a background of my background in a summary of my background in a nutshell. I hope it will help the readers, your listeners, understand where I'm coming from.
Well, this is very, very important. So they know where you are and what you've been trying to do for our country to expose a direction that most of us are not privy to, because you know, we're always given these directions of situations that confuse us. The CIA is constantly being blamed for bringing drugs into the country, and yet we don't even hear anything about what you've been covering in your book.
No, that's true. And you know, the way I got into the book really is my children were becoming teenagers, Mm-hmm. And this was in the early 80s, and I said to myself, gee, you know, this is, I don't know anything about this. I better learn something about it because it troubles me. So I started reading a bunch of stuff, and I was just becoming of getting some publicity through a number of congressional hearings, which added to the material that was out there. As I read through the material, what struck me from my knowledge then of the communist system and how it worked was that we weren't being told the right story. And so I went back and I actually called Jan Sena, the Czech general that I've been talking about before, although at that time he was not going, he was at a hidden assumed name that he had taken on from the agency. And I'll get back to you after this music.
Wonderful, wonderful. We're with, once again, listeners, Joseph D. Douglas, Jr., the author of Red Cocaine, The Drugging of America, and Hanza Molina, who you're very familiar with. We'll take your phone calls in the second hour. If you have any questions, write them down as we go through this first hour, because this is going to be very revolutionary information, stuff you really haven't been acquainted with. Stay with us. We'll be back. As well as supporting the sponsors, listeners, the pledge drive continues on this network, Republic Broadcasting. That pledge drive phone number is 800-724-2719, 800-724-2719. Once again, any questions you may have in the second hour, be sure to write them down, jot them down now, and we're going to kind of turn this over to Hanza, as he's been quoting from your book, Dr. Douglas, quite often.
Yes.
And so, Hanza, why don't you go ahead and kind of take over the interview a little bit here, Hanza?
Well, I have to appreciate the knowledge and the depth of knowledge Dr. Douglas has, because some of this information is not known to me as far as when I lived in Czechoslovakia, and this was totally concealed from us ordinary citizens back then. So even though I served in the Czechoslovak military, I was drafted. I never knew a whole lot of stuff that was going on because it was not known to ordinary people. And this brings a lot more details and perspective to what I went through in my life. So I'm really thankful for Dr. Douglas for putting it into these important books and spreading it around. I meant to ask you quite a few questions. I don't even know where to begin, but I have just recently there was an indication that the second in command of Al Qaeda, Ayman al-Zawahiri, was in fact trained by Russia in 1998 in the FSB training camp in the former Soviet Republic of Dagestan. Now, I'm saying all along that the collapse of communism is a fraud, and that Russians organized it to deceive America and bring America to the disarming table to get us involved in sort of phony cooperation with the Soviet bloc. And meantime, the Russians had open doors to continue with their strategy to implement communism around the world. Now, to use the Chechen mafia as far as the facilitator of Russian nuclear bombs to Al Qaeda, would it be possible, in your opinion, that Russians would even consider this as a sort of like to allow that to happen as far as their policies and their strategy?
In terms of the passing of nuclear warheads.
Right.
My view of that is it is highly unlikely. The Soviets have a tremendous concern over the security of nuclear weapons. Their concern, as did the United States, and does the United States, as I should point out, our concern was that somebody might get a weapon and prematurely use it against the enemy and thus escalate a war. And what is very strange is the Soviet approach had nothing to do with that. The Soviet concern was that an army commander might get a hold of a nuclear weapon inadvertently and use it against the Soviets themselves. You know, again, it's a 180-degree out-of-phase view of nuclear problems. But as this shows the paranoia of the Soviet Union in terms of considering the reliability of their own people and their own friends, their own military, if you will. Now, the idea of them providing a nuclear weapon to a terrorist operation, even though it is one that is basically linked directly to them, I think is very unlikely, because I don't think they would want to take that chance with something like a nuclear weapon. However, if there were a case that the Soviets wanted to start a war with the United States, or wanted to attack the United States, let's say, or make some type of very unusual demonstration, the best way to do something like that, and a scenario that was not really available or ever thought of, to my knowledge, really very much in the United States, back when nuclear war was a real possibility, particularly, say, in the 60s and 70s, the best way they could do this would be to make that use of nuclear weapons, one or two, say, or maybe more, appear that it was done by a terrorist group or another group. Now, in that case, whether they would entrust the group with a nuclear weapon to put it into place so the Soviets weren't even detected, or whether they would want to do it themselves and just have enough of the other terrorists around so as to leave a trail that it was clearly a terrorist operation, I'm not sure on that case. I suspect what they would do, since they have agents within Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups, that they would probably entrust the operation to one of their own agents, so that they would should be expected, if they wanted to go this route, to basically deploy the weapon in a covert manner through one of their own agents and explode it in a way that the whatever evidence there was around pointed the route toward the terrorists and not toward the Soviet Union. This then gives them the opportunity to basically, if you think even in a broader context, to initiate a strike without warning that the Soviets could not, that the United States could not respond to, because we would not have any real idea of where it came from. So it is really the only way that I've seen in basically 35 years in looking at the nuclear war problem that you could really have, or really could undertake, a very effective surprise first strike that the enemy, us, could not respond to. So, you know, in that case, I think you could have a connection between a terrorist use of a nuclear weapon and the United States. But, you know, when you look at the problem of these loose nukes and loose uranium over in Russia, which have been portrayed as being very loose, when you look at them, what they have been used for is basically to justify the movement of billions of dollars, U.S. taxpayer dollars, over to help the Soviet Union, who had really not disarmed. And so I think it's mainly a ploy and not a real threat in the normal sense of the word.
Very, very interesting. Listeners, we're with Dr. Joseph Douglas, the author of Red Cocaine, The Drugging of America, and Hanza Molina is with us as well, Czechoslovakian defector. We'll take your calls in the second hour. Write down those questions, and we'll be happy to entertain your questions in the second hour. Stay with us. Podcast listeners, the pledge drive is underway. 800-724-2719. 800-724-2719. Dr. Douglas, I see here from the repository out of Canton, Ohio, dated September 5th, 1997, in the National Briefs section, Russia loses track of 100 nuke bombs. Russia's military has lost track of 100 suitcase-sized nuclear bombs, the nation's former national security chiefs has told American lawmakers who expressed alarm to the Clinton administration. But U.S. and Russian officials discount the claims by retired General Lebed, the ousted one-time foe of President Boris Yeltsin. Quote, we don't have any evidence to support what Lebed said, and responsible Russian officials have specifically denied it, end quote, a White House official said Thursday. The one-kiloton nuclear bombs, which weigh 60 to 100 pounds and can fit into a suitcase or a backpack, can kill 50 to 100,000 people and devastate a portion of a city, according to Lebed. What is your read on this article from 1997, Dr. Douglas?
Well, there's been a lot of talk about missing nuclear weapons. And frankly, I just don't know what stock we would put in it. My feeling is that there were two security systems that the Soviets had with nuclear weapons. And one of those was military intelligence, counterintelligence, and the other was KGB. And you had two parallel security, two parallel and independent security systems. It strikes me as I would not really expect them to lose track of weapons because, they really very rarely even lose track of an individual. A nuclear weapon is more important than an individual. So I wouldn't believe it unless I'd known it. I do think that nuclear weapons, I'm well familiar with the problem of keeping track of nuclear weapons because I spent several years involved in addressing that problem insofar as the U.S. stockpile was concerned. And there you're talking about, tens of thousands of nuclear weapons. And while at one point in time, you never knew which was where for sure because there were so many that were always on the move, yet I'm not aware that we ever really lost any track of any nuclear weapons at all. It's just it was very difficult counting them because there were many that were on the move at any one time. And I suspect the same was true in a similar sense in the Soviet Union. But as to whether or not there are any missing, I don't think we have the slightest idea. And if there's one thing that's true, you can never trust a Soviet to tell you anything but what they want you to know. Occasionally you'll have some elements of truth come out, but it's very, very difficult to find anybody that you really haven't, who you can listen to without keeping in the back of your mind that they're one of their main characteristics. The characteristics of the country, of the people, of the culture, is deception, not telling the truth.
That's the whole game plan. In other words, you still refer to them as Soviets when actually we're told the Soviet Union collapsed.
A lot of that is just force of habit.
Uh-huh.
If I'd been studying when they were Russians, I would refer to the Soviets as Russians more than as Soviets because we're talking about the Russian people.
Uh-huh.
It's very interesting. One time I was reading a book, two books within about 2 weeks of each other. One was A Journey for Our Times by the Marquis de Castaigne, and that is similar to de Kochfeld's Democracy in America, except his journal on his impressions of the Soviet Union, of Russia, really, when he was visiting there in about the same time. I think it was about 1847 or so. And I was comparing that with a book by Hedrick Smith, whose title was The Russians, that he wrote after the Soviet Union had taken over, I think, must have been in the mid-60s or something like that. But I forget the time. But at any rate, what was interesting is that in both books, the main stress on the characteristic of the people and the culture was the extent to which they had to rely upon deception to survive and how that had become a major portion of the culture. And I would say it was as important and ingrained in the Russian culture as in the United States culture. At least when you and I were growing up, one of the main characteristics was tell the truth. George Washington, I cut down the cherry tree, whatever it was. Very different cultures, and we have no concept, really, of what deception in the Soviet Union is like. I recall in many conversations with Jan Sena how I'd look back on, several hours of conversation, and what amazed me most was the amount of time we spent talking about deception, and that you couldn't get into any subject that he didn't bring in deception. And particularly in the decision-making process, whenever a decision was made, there was a sort of a decision document, and there was always an annex. That annex was called the political plan, and it was an annex that was focused on the operational deception that would be undertaken to facilitate the implementation of the decision. And they had a deception plan not only for making the decision go through more smoothly, but they also had backup deception plans for what would happen if the thing, the decision and the implementation, all of a sudden became exposed, the bad aspects of it came out. They had a deception plan already to cover that and to force the blame elsewhere, change the focus of the debate or the news, what have you. They were always thinking deception. It always entered into every decision process, every decision implementation, and into every discussion they had with foreign people.
Hansa refers to this situation that we live today as a chess match with the Russians.
Sure.
Does that make sense to you?
Oh, absolutely. It's sort of like we play poker, they play chess.
Yeah, that's what I'm good at. I got a really good example of their deception from a book of a British terrorism expert, Simon Reeve. The book is called The New Jackals, and I'm quoting from it right here. It's on page 215. It says, reports emerging from Israel and Russia suggest that bin Laden gave his contacts in the Chechen mafia several millions of dollars in cash and heroin with street value of more than $500 million. In exchange, the Chechens launched an all-out campaign to obtain nuclear suitcase bombs for Al-Qaeda.
Mm-hmm.
So now this is exactly what the Russians would like us to know, in my opinion, because that points out to Al-Qaeda. But Dr. Douglas, I wanted to ask you, I read about Shamil Basayev, being a former Red Army paratrooper, and he's the basically chief of the Chechen mafia. When I served in Czechoslovak Air Force, we had separate unit that was trained as paratroopers. They were totally separated from us.
It was Spetsnaz type of thing.
Well, there were special forces. Yes.
Yeah.
And so these were hardened communists. So it's totally impossible for me to accept that such a highly trained officer would all of a sudden become a born-again Muslim. And also what the Chechen mafia is doing to facilitate nuclear bombs to Al-Qaeda, why not use them to fight their own fight against the Russian government? And since there were no Russian government military government targets, as far as what the Chechen mafia strike, it makes sense to me that these kind of deceptions are pointed at us as far as to let us know that this is all Al-Qaeda and that the Russian state has nothing to do with it.
Sure, that makes sense to me too. And I can see where they by having this image of Al-Qaeda or other terrorist groups having nuclear weapons, it creates all sorts of wonderful opportunities for chaos if you really want to use them.
Right. And I had a question. Since bin Laden has such a contact as far as, selling heroin, is it possible that he would be dealing with independent organizations, or would there be, again, Russian-organized narcotic trafficking groups and controlled by the KGB and GRU?
Certainly independent contacts would be possible because their only concern really is that the heroin flows in the right direction. And if it doesn't flow in the right direction, then the person may find himself fertilizing daisies. So that doesn't surprise me. It also surprises me that people view this tremendous surge of heroin, which moves through a lot of the republics now from the Afghanistan area into Germany and other places, as being without any Soviet participation. And, of course, this has not been the case in the past, because the main transporter of drugs, the main organizer of drug trafficking for 40 years has really been the Russians, Russian intelligence, if you will, particularly military intelligence. And that just of course, never gets out. That possibility never gets out into the papers because one would not want to acknowledge that our great ally might be actually not our ally. It would be an embarrassment to U.S. policy.
Very, very interesting.
There's a lot of egos behind this, too, that people invested their egos and money into trusting the communists and allowing themselves to cooperate and sign anything with the communists and not realizing that they're basically signing death warrants and treaties with criminals.
Absolutely.
Let me real quick read from the next page from that book because it's quite interesting. Now this is about the Chechen mafia also because the Chechens need Bin Laden to facilitate their drug deals with the Taliban leadership. They are extremely unlikely to have accepted the money on his heroin if they were unable to supply the suitcase bombs. According to one senior American intelligence source close to America's Bin Laden investigation, officials from Al-Qaeda, or possibly senior members of the Taliban, obtained several of the nuclear suitcase bombs in the autumn of 1998 and transferred them into storage in the Taliban's main secure complex near Kandahar in Afghanistan. There appears to be some confusion, however, within the intelligence community over whether the bombs are still programmed with Soviet-era coding system that requires a signal from Moscow before detonation is possible. The Russian government refuses to comment on the allegations, but by early 1999, there were strong rumors in the Central Asian states that Chechen rebels, in this case the mafia, were hoping to recruit former Soviet special forces. It is possible Al-Qaeda or the Taliban need these recruits to explain and work the coded control system of the suitcase bombs. Isn't it exactly this what the Russians want us to know?
Or believe.
Or belief, yeah.
It goes back to Dzerzhinsky. Tell them what they want to believe. His guidance, or Lenin's guidance to Dzerzhinsky when they were launching the new economic plan, said, well, what should we tell the enemy? And Lenin replied, tell them what they want to believe. That was the basis, sort of a wonderful basis for guidance on deception.
You know, Afghanistan is very confusing to a lot of people in this country. The Soviets invaded Afghanistan and then they left almost 10 years later saying it was their Vietnam. Did they not leave a puppet government in place to be subservient to Russia?
No, they did leave a government. As a matter of fact, I believe they left in the process of that leaving. I think they assassinated the people in charge. The government and put new people in that were basically tied to Moscow.
And was Afghanistan a country where they could nurture terrorist organizations after that happened?
It would certainly seem so. As a matter of fact, thinking back on it, it's been a long time since I thought about that, Chris. I recall, they took quite a few people from Afghanistan into Tajikistan or one of those neighboring republics to train them in terrorist and subversive activities and then re-infiltrated them back after a year or two. So I think it goes picking up on what you said, it goes way beyond that. It really involved more than necessarily the training of people in Afghanistan, the taking of people from Afghanistan into various Soviet republics, training them there, and then inserting them back in.
And there's where the deception lies, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
Hansa, anything?
Yeah, I have. I'm looking at a book. It's an amazing book written. I believe you know the author. Douglas, it's written by British author Brian Crozier.
Yes.
And it's called KGB Lawsuits. It's a fascinating book. And I sort of began to think that the Russians, in fact, to steer our foreign policy and domestic policy in the United States, they must have set up, or at least helped set up various think tanks in America or infiltrate the existing ones in order to prevent America to understand what really goes on and as far as the Russian strategy. And I'm reading from the case of the Institute for Policy Study. And there are people that actually have ties from this institute to the Cuban communists, which were always run by, in fact, by the KGB, at least since the KGB succeeded in infiltrating the intelligence networks in Cuba. And I know you published this in the Red Cocaine. I was wondering if you had any thoughts on as far as the way of thinking of America in this regard, how this is being spread around it, as far as terrorism goes and the narco trafficking and all these strategies, so Moscow would never be seen behind these operations.
Let me pick up on just that last little phrase first, so that the Soviets would never be seen as lurking behind these operations. That is the essence of nearly all the Soviet operations in the intelligence area and covert areas. Always work, train and work with indigenous people, so they basically are your surrogates, so that nobody understands that you're behind the operation.
Dr. Douglas, I thought, you know, are you able to stay with us for a little while longer, are you?
Yeah, I can stick around here for a while.
Okay, very, very good. We sure appreciate it. 800-313-9443. Just call in. Broadcast, keep in mind that pledge drive, 800-724-2719, 800-724-2719. Support this network how you can to keep this operation flowing like it is so well. Dr. Douglas, anything to respond to before
we
move on?
Let me finish a couple more comments here on this excellent question that Hansa put forth here at the end of the last session.
Mm-hmm.
First, the question is, who's behind institutes like the IPS and other questionable operations in the United States, of which, you know, hundreds of questionable operations, I should say. A tremendously important question. It is so complex that it would take us 2 hours just to get into it. Basically, what he's saying is, who sponsors these institutes, where does the money come from, and why? Why it is so complex is because it deals not just with the Soviet Union, but with agencies within the United States government and the private sector that are part of the problem here. And one cannot really even address this question without getting into the functions of the major foundations, the origins and background of the CIA, and also Comintern channels, that's Communist International channels, who has basically their own a global intelligence operation, has had since Lenin started them off. In all these cases, these are the some of the main culprits that you have to get into, and that takes a lot of time, and because people just don't understand what is happening here within the United States. But the thing I really think was interesting is that book, KGB Lawsuits. The author, Brian Crozier, is a very unusual individual. He's a genius. He's one of the unheralded heroes in the Cold War that anybody that really wants to hear from a guy that was there and doesn't blow his own horn. To go back and look at some of the books of Brian Crozier. A fantastic author, a Cold War warrior, if you will, who operated strictly behind the scenes, and also a concert pianist and composer, a very interesting guy. Other interesting thing about that book is one of the situations that really kicked it off was a lawsuit that was brought against Sir James Goldsmith by, I believe it was Der Spiegel, after James Goldsmith accused them of abetting in Soviet propaganda and being basically a propaganda organ, if you will. And the person who provided the key testimony that forced the lawsuit to back down again was General Jan Sena. And as a matter of fact, Brian told me of the problem of was being posed by this lawsuit and the need to take care of it. I started again searching my memory. It struck me that Jan Sena would probably know something about it. And lo and behold, he knew a lot about the Soviet propaganda operations as a component of the deception area. And so I got him in touch with Brian, and that led to the cancellation of this very major lawsuit, and was also, I think, one of the key things that led into this whole book, The KGB Lawsuits. A fascinating book, and very interesting, and thank you for bringing it up, Hansa. Enjoyed that book very much.
Yeah, that's a great book. As far as I'm concerned, there's great information that I was searching for. It's regarding the Greek case of KGB set up their own magazine in Greece.
Yes.
Facilitating the KGB propaganda throughout the West.
You bet. Very important one.
We'll continue with this into the second hour. Listeners, Hansa Molina, former Czechoslovakian Republic defector, and Red Cocaine author Joseph Douglas. Stay with us, 800-313-9443, if you want to get involved.